9.5 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, the 1st of October, 2007. Some parts of the state are a little wet this morning, others are not. I hope it's nice wherever you are. We'll try and make it nice on the radio for you. Well, it's fall, and with fall comes the start of a new Supreme Court term, and there are major issues to be decided this year, some of which will have an election year impact. We want to talk about those this hour. The court under new Chief Justice Roberts demonstrated that it could go to the right in the last term with a number of decisions, particularly in the civil rights area. How will the court vote in this term? There are a different set of issues that are coming up, and things may not be the same as what some people have assumed. So we'll try and handicap the court decisions that are coming up, talk a little bit about the cases that the court is considering and what the implications are, and perhaps speculate a little bit with you about what may happen. You can join our discussion of the Supreme Court of the United States and its cases by calling us at 800-642-1234, or if you're in Madison, use our local number 263-1890. You can also use the internet. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Joining us by phone to help us figure out what's going on with the Supreme Court of the United States, we have Edward Lazarus, a lawyer and legal analyst, who's also the author of the book Closed Chambers, The Rise, Fall, and Future of the Modern Supreme Court. Mr. Lazarus, good morning, and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So the Supreme Court of the United States is starting its fall term. What's the common wisdom in terms of where the court is likely to be on major issues in this term?
Well, I think the common wisdom is that last year's turn to the right is going to continue. It's not a common wisdom I subscribe to, but this is a closely divided court. And everything is up to Anthony Kennedy. And Kennedy kind of swings from right to left depending on which issue is before him. Last term, on the issues of civil rights and abortion rights, he's on the right, on the conservative side of the court. But a number of the issues that are coming up this year, I think, will appeal to his more liberal instincts, and he may well end up on the left side.
Well, it's if this were a football game, we'd be setting the starting lineups for you. But let's talk about who's on first and so forth. On the conservative side, you've got Chief Justice Roberts, and then Justices Scalia, Alito, and Thomas. The so-called liberal justices would be Breyer, Stevens, Ginsburg, and Souter. And then, as you mentioned, the swing vote is Kennedy. He was the fifth vote in all the 5-4 decisions last spring, was he not?
That's correct. He is by far the most significant justice up there in terms of winning. And of course, they all have an equal vote, but his is the vote that actually counts in pretty much every hot-button case.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the cases that the court has agreed to take. And, of course, they don't have to take just any case that happens to show up. They get to decide which cases they'll rule on and which they won't.
That's exactly right. In fact, they receive about 9,000 petitions every year of people who want the court to hear their cases, and they take about 80. So that gives you a sense of what a tremendous process it is just to decide which things are going to make it to the docket.
Now, and as I was coming to the station this morning about 4:30, I happened to hear on Morning Edition a portion of a report by Nina Totenberg talking about the Supreme Court caseload coming up, and one of the cases that was alluded to had to do with how the government looks at fraud and some things having to do with business transactions. And I didn't catch all of that, and I've been trying to catch up with it the rest of the morning, and I haven't been able to do it yet. Can you shed any light on this?
Well, one thing that's important for people to remember is, although the headlines tend to be caught by cases that involve the social issues or moral issues or issues that are politically oriented, the court also decides a lot of very important business cases. And for example, one case they'll be hearing early in the term has to do with accounting fraud and whether a company can be held liable under what's called an aiding and abetting theory for accounting fraud. Now, all these things sound highly technical, and that one is, but if you're in the accounting business, it's enormously important. And there are other cases, you know, whether it's in the field of patents or in taxation or other areas of business, where what the Supreme Court has to say can really affect your bottom line.
The big headline cases, though, as we come into this topic this morning, one of them has to do with a new voter ID law that was passed in Indiana, which is pretty restrictive compared to other voter ID laws that have been passed. You have to have either a state or federal issued photo ID in order to be able to vote in Indiana, and this law was passed, according to its sponsors, to combat voter fraud. This case has wound its way up to the Supreme Court. Lots of implications for the 2008 election. What can you tell us about this case and maybe speculate on which way the court is likely to come down?
Well, there are actually two cases. There's also a similar law in Georgia that's up for grabs. The basic debate here is between those who tend to be on the Republican side, who say you need to have these voter ID laws to combat voter fraud, and those on the other side who say there are lots of low-income people who don't have government-issue IDs. They don't walk around going into stores needing IDs to purchase expensive items and things like that, and they just don't have them, and those people will not get access to the ballot under these state laws. I think, you know, this will definitely be one of those close cases. I think it'll probably come out in favor of, ironically enough, in favor of the Democrats, of the more liberal view, because I think Tony Kennedy is going to look at the evidence, and there's not a lot of evidence of significant voter fraud. It certainly is true that it's a reasonable justification for a law like this, but I think Kennedy's a very fact-oriented judge, and I think he may decide that there's just not enough evidence that such fraud is a significant problem in these states to warrant this kind of impingement on the fundamental right to vote.
Let's take a call from John in Schofield, who I think has a question that relates to something you just mentioned a few moments ago. John, good morning. Thanks for calling us today.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call. The guest just mentioned there's 9,000 applications, I guess, to be heard. And I was wondering, is there a gatekeeper, or do the justices, clerks, decide which cases or which applications going forward, or how do they really decide that the 90 cases they're going to hear? And I'll listen off the air. Thanks a lot.
Great question, John. Thanks. How do they decide? I mean, that's a lot of cases.
The justices vote on all the petitions. Basically, the way it works is that a clerk in one of the justices' chambers writes a memorandum for his own justice or her own justice, and seven other justices. There are eight justices who are in something called the cert pool, which is that process. Justice Stevens makes all of his own decisions about what cases he wants to vote to grant. The Chief Justice compiles, after the memo goes around, the Chief Justice compiles a list of what he thinks are the ones that are worthy of discussion. It's called the discuss list, and it gets sent around. And every justice can add a petition to the discuss list. If no one adds anything, those are the only cases that will actually get taken up at the justices' secret conference where they hold a vote. It takes four votes to get a court granted for review, so it actually just requires a minority of four justices to want to hear a case for it to get put on the docket. The truth is that the vast majority of cases do not raise the kind of issues that the Supreme Court's interested in. The Supreme Court really only decides issues of broad significance. Even if they think that the lower court got a case wrong, they're not going to correct that error unless they think that this is the kind of thing that might come up over and over again. So when you go through all these things as a law clerk or as a justice, you can sort out sort of the 90% that have no chance, the 1% that you know you're going to take to review, and then you sort of make decisions on the other 8 or 9% that's left over.
One of the other cases that's going to be taken up this session has to do with lethal injection, and that was a case that was just decided by the court to take last week. This is of great interest to both opponents and proponents of capital punishment because it has to do with the kinds of chemicals used and the way that they're used to execute criminals. I believe this case was based on, came from a couple of death row inmates in Kentucky, if I remember my notes correctly, and could be a very significant case. What can you tell us about this case?
Well, you've got it exactly right. It's two death row inmates from Kentucky. 37 of the 38 death penalty states in the country use the same three-drug concoction in order to kill people. They've been using the same three drugs for several decades now. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that these drugs don't actually do the job very well and that they inflict gratuitous pain on the person being put to death. The basic debate here is going to be between the more conservative justices who really do not believe that the court should be in the business of micromanaging the death penalty and those justices on the more liberal side who view the Constitution as covering this kind of thing.
Now, the Supreme Court hasn't ruled a specific type of punishment as unconstitutional for quite a few years. I'm trying to remember when the last time was. It was quite a long time ago.
Well, they haven't taken up an issue like this in over 100 years since, I believe, the case is Wilkerson versus Utah. And in that case, they ruled that it was okay to use the firing squad. This is not the kind of challenge that ordinarily comes up, but it's been percolating through the system now for a long time. There's all over the country there are these cases involving challenges to the use of lethal injection. At least three of the more liberal justices have previously indicated an interest in this issue, and I think it's fair to guess an interest in not allowing states to use outmoded types of drugs to kill people, but it's going to be another very, very close case.
Now, the three-injection cocktail that is used to execute prisoners, I believe the first one is a more or less a painkiller. The second one is some sort of a drug that interferes with respiration, I think. And then the third one is basically just potassium chloride. It makes the heart stop. Is that your understanding as well?
That's exactly right. The real question has to do, I think, especially with drug one, which is a short-acting anesthesia, and some say doesn't really work, and there are more modern anesthetics that would be more effective. And I think there's also a question as to whether you need both drug two, which is kind of a paralytic, as I understand it. It basically paralyzes.
Yeah, paralyzes. You're paralyzed, including your ability to breathe.
Correct. And then the heart stopper is the rock salt that they, potassium chloride. So it's... But I think from a legal point of view, the question is going to be, is this the kind of matter that is properly given to the discretion of states, or is this something where the Constitution actually dictates a standard of what level of risk of pain would create a cruel and unusual punishment? That's the key phrase in the Constitution. The Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. And is it cruel and unusual to use this cocktail if, in fact, there's a substantial risk of unnecessary pain?
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some of the other cases that the court will talk about and some issues revolving around the Supreme Court of the United States. Perhaps we'll talk about the politicization of the court and, there's just... all kinds of things to talk about, and this is a subject I must confess that I'm quite a bit interested in, having studied it quite a lot when I was a college student, which I admit was a long time ago. Not quite back to Marbury versus Madison, but perhaps close. But I'd like it if the rest of us could get in on this discussion, too, and here's how you do that. You can call us at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234 is a toll-free number anywhere that you can hear this broadcast. You can use that number. If you're in Madison, though, we'd appreciate it if you'd use our local number, 263-1890, 263-1890. If you'd like to send an email, that's fine, too. The address is talk@wpr.org. My guest this hour, Edward Lazarus, lawyer and legal analyst and also the author of Closed Chambers, The Rise, Fall, and Future of the Modern Supreme Court. Supreme Court of the United States is our topic this hour. Call in and let us know what you think. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:25 on this Monday, October 1st, 2007. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the Supreme Court of the United States, the new term just about to get started, trying to see which way the court will lean on various cases before it, and what Justice Kennedy will be doing this time. He seems to be the key vote, the swing vote in cases. And in the last session, he was leaning to the right. But some of the cases coming before the court this term, it's been suggested that he may go the other way, because they're the kinds of cases he would do that on, and that would skew the court a little bit to the left. So I guess lean to the left, lean to the right, stand up. No, I'm not going to go there. Let's give the phone numbers again, and then I want to mention what else is coming up on the Ideas Network this morning and this afternoon. 800-642-1234. It's a toll-free number, 263-1890, if you're calling us from Madison. Well, later on this morning, Larry Mueller's personal computer consultant is in after 11 to offer advice on solving your PC woes. He is Peter Green of InfoStar in Madison. That's after 11 this morning here on the Ideas Network. My guest this hour is Edward Lazarus, lawyer and legal analyst and author of the book Closed Chambers, The Rise, Fall, and Future of the Modern Supreme Court. Well, just before the break, Mr. Lazarus, we were talking about the death penalty and particularly lethal injection and whether or not that could be ruled a cruel and unusual punishment, your point being that the court may decide that this isn't an issue that should be decided at the Supreme Court level and perhaps lies with the states. Why do you think they decided to take this issue? If that's the feeling, how did this issue get on the docket? Were there four justices who said, no, we want to discuss this?
Yes, I think that is exactly right. They don't always take the cases. Sometimes people on each side of the issue may take the case because they want to push the court in one direction or another. In this circumstance, there's so many states out there that are wrestling with this particular problem of lethal injection. There are, I believe, 7 or 8 states that have actually suspended their death penalty processes while they review this this matter. There's several courts that are considering it in California. So I think one of the reasons the justices took it was that they felt they had to resolve the question once and for all. Either federal courts are going to get into the business of overseeing the methods of execution, or they're not, and the justices decided it was time for them to provide an answer one way or the other.
Let's go back to the phones and take a call this time from Paul in Slinger. Paul, good morning. Thanks for calling us today. What's your comment or question?
Good morning. As I understand it, judges now at all levels can retain and call in experts as it regards to cases that are highly complex and technical, either on an engineering level or a medical level. And the question is, I don't know the name or the term they use, but do Supreme Court justices consult and retain, obviously for a fee, to answer complex questions that they necessarily are not schooled in?
That's a very good question. The answer is basically no. The normal term for an expert like that is a special master, and the lower courts do sometimes use special masters to help them in particularly technical disputes. But at the Supreme Court level, special masters are very rare. They sometimes come up in boundary disputes between states where the court will have an expert look at that question and make a recommendation to them. But I cannot think of another circumstance in which the Supreme Court has ever called in its own independent expert as a consultant.
Thanks for that call. Let's go next to Ron in Abrams. Ron, good morning. Thanks for calling us.
Good morning. I was wondering, seeing how you have these judges deciding this, that, and the other thing, and then he said that generally there's one particular judge that always has a swing vote, it would seem to me like he's the one that kind of runs everything then.
Well, I think there's a fair amount of truth to that. It's not necessarily that he runs everything, but at the end of the day, both sides of any case, both inside and outside the court, are vying for Justice Kennedy's vote, and so they try and tailor their arguments in ways that they think will appeal to Justice Kennedy. Of course, the court's not always been this way, but in a lot of respects, now the court mirrors our country, which is a very closely divided country.
Well, I think that's important to note that the court is a reflection of the country, and oftentimes popular opinion actually can have some impact on how the court decides things. And right now, popular opinion on almost every issue is pretty divided, and that's reflected in the Supreme Court.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And while the justices don't follow the election results, you know, that's the old saying, they are affected to some degree by public opinion. They don't want to be too far out in front of where the country is or lag too far behind, because they are, after all, they serve for life, they're unelected, they're kind of an anomaly in our democratic system, and they don't want to find themselves way out on a limb one way or the other.
What about, Justice Kennedy isn't the only justice who's been a real swing vote. Wasn't Justice Sandra Day O'Connor in a similar position?
Yes. In terms of holding down the balance of the court, for many years, Justice O'Connor really occupied the role that Justice Kennedy does now, or maybe more accurately, the two of them did it together, but more often O'Connor was the swing vote than Justice Kennedy was. But they had a very different style about how they decided cases. Justice O'Connor tended to decide cases based on very narrow, sort of case-specific approaches, whereas Justice Kennedy writes in a very sweeping way. So while they both have held down the center of the court, Justice Kennedy tends to move more dramatically from the right side of a case to the left side, depending on the issue, than O'Connor, who tended to work within a very narrow ideological range.
I want to talk more about some of the specific cases that the court has agreed to take, and I don't want to discourage people from asking questions about how the Supreme Court works, but I'd like to try to steer the discussion more toward some of the issues that the court is facing. Here, one of the huge ones, and this I think everybody is going to be paying attention to this, involves issues of executive power and habeas corpus, and that's the case of the Guantanamo detainees and what rights they may have. The court has already ruled on this once, and that prompted Congress to go back and pass a new law, and now we've got more cases in front of the Supreme Court. To background us on this and handicap this case for us as in terms of how you think it might come out.
Well, as you point out, this is round two of the Guantanamo cases, and the first time round, the court very strongly rebuffed the Bush administration's claims to executive authority to be able to basically deal with the Guantanamo detainees as it saw fit. The court basically said, if you want to have military commissions to try these people, you need to have Congress enact the structure of these military commissions. So Congress went back and it passed the Military Commissions Act of 2006. And when it did that, it stripped the Guantanamo detainees of any right to habeas corpus. And what that means, basically, is that the detainees will not be able to challenge the nature of their trials in federal court. Now, there is a clause of the Constitution saying that Congress cannot suspend the writ of habeas corpus. And so these cases before the court today involve the question of whether Congress, in depriving these detainees of a right to federal court, has gone beyond the powers that the Constitution gives to Congress.
Isn't one of the arguments here is that these aren't U.S. citizens, and so they don't get the rights that U.S. citizens might be accorded, or am I wrong on that?
No, that's right. I mean, there are lots of different ways that these cases get sliced up. There are those people who are U.S. citizens, those who aren't U.S. citizens. There are some who are detained in the United States, others on Guantanamo, where the government argues that's actually not U.S. territory. There are quite a number of variables at work in these cases. But the bottom line question here is going to be, what is the power of Congress, mainly in the circumstance of non-U.S. citizens, to deprive these people of the right to get into federal court to challenge the way they are being detained.
And then another big issue, and this one, there were some surprising aspects to me as I was researching this in preparation for this morning's broadcast, is the issue of the gun control law passed in the District of Columbia, which could really go a long ways toward defining exactly what the Second Amendment reads or means. And I was surprised to discover that the court really hadn't ever ruled on the subject of whether the Second Amendment means that there's supposed to be a state militia and that that's what the amendment refers to, or if it refers to individual gun ownership.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There is some language in a case dating back to the 1930s suggesting that the court viewed the Second Amendment as being oriented towards the formation of state militias and not towards an individual right to own guns. But and that was the position of the Justice Department up until quite recently. But but as I'm sure people who follow the issue know, there has been a very strongly asserted view by those who favor gun rights that in fact this is an individual right. Even if that's true, it raises the question of, you know, like every individual right we have, including the right to free speech, those things are regulated. There are limits to those rights, and whether certain kinds of handgun laws would pass, even if you thought it was an amendment directed at the individual right to own a gun. You know, what kinds of limits could be placed on that? In D.C., they have a quite strict handgun ban, and that is the law that is being challenged at the moment. The D.C. Court of Appeals struck down this ban by a 2-1 vote, and now it's gone up to the Supreme Court, and they will, as you say, opine on this officially for the first time ever.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join our discussion. We're talking about the cases that are coming before the Supreme Court of the United States this term under Chief Justice Roberts, who is a Bush appointee, and how the court's likely to rule on some of these cases. And we'd like you to weigh in on them as well. What do you think? What do you think about voter ID? Is this a good idea? Is there really the kind of voter fraud that would justify the state taking an action like requiring people to have a photo ID and present it when they go vote? What do you think about that? What about the rights of detainees at Guantanamo? Do they have any? Should they have any? Is the fact that some people say we're at war and therefore things are a little bit different. Even Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War. What do you think about that? And what about the Second Amendment? Does it really pertain to state militias, or does this is this right for individual citizens and have really nothing to do with militias? These are pretty hot-button issues. I'm sure that nobody out there listening is neutral on any of them. And we'd like to hear what you have to say about this. What about the Supreme Court? What about the what some would say has been the increasing politicization of the court over the last decade or two? Or is has the court always been political? What do you think? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, toll free from anywhere you can hear me. And 263-1890, 263-1890 is the number we'd like you to use if you're calling from Madison. My guest is Edward Lazarus. He is a lawyer and legal analyst. He's also the author of the book Closed Chambers, The Rise, Fall, and Future of the Modern Supreme Court. We're here to take your calls and emails. By the way, the email address is talk@wpr.org, and we'll get back to our discussion and your phone calls right after we take a short break. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine this week, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 20 minutes before 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine this week. Well, students and parents are often preoccupied with college rankings during the admissions process. After 5 today, Ben Marins and his guests discuss the New York Times Magazine poll of current college students. That's after 5 today here on the Ideas Network. This hour, the Supreme Court of the United States is the topic under discussion, and we're discussing what the court will discuss, what cases they are going to take up. We've touched on a few of them, And we have some more to talk about, but we want to get some phone calls in as well because we know our listeners like to participate in this kind of discussion. My guest this hour is Edward Lazarus, lawyer and legal analyst. He's the author of Closed Chambers, The Rise, Fall, and Future of the Modern Supreme Court. Let's go back to the phones and take a call from Diana in Madison, who's been waiting patiently. Diana, thanks for holding.
Sure. Thank you for your program. I guess I'll weigh in with my comment and then ask my question. I am against the Guantanamo people being held without due process. I just think setting an example and giving them rights that we say other people should have in a democracy, I think that's why we should do it. And forgot what the other one was.
Well, you had a question about the workings of the court. I think you wanted to know
the
role of the clerks were.
Yes, because we have Madison, the first clerk, and she's a woman, too, first time in 40 years. And how do they pick them, and what role do they have? And now that you've said that they prepare these briefs, how much influence does that give to the clerks?
Well, the clerks are important, Mr. Lazarus. How are they chosen, and exactly what do they do?
Well, each justice has four clerks. They are recent law school graduates, usually 2 years out of law school. They will have clerked on a lower federal court before getting to the U.S. Supreme Court. They are top graduates from the top law schools, and they serve as law clerks for just 1 year. They are important parts of the court's machinery. In addition to playing a role in the selection of cases, they also often, in many of the chambers, do the first drafts of all the opinions. So it's a very, very important position, and the justices come to rely on the clerks, quite a bit. Of course, it's not the clerks who cast the votes. It's not the clerks who decide what the ultimate draft of the opinion is going to say. But depending on which justice you work for, right, and how heavy an editor that justice is, they do have, a lot of influence over exactly what the opinions look like.
Thanks for the call, Diana. What about, Diana thinks it's important for the United States to set an example for the rest of the world and make sure that we treat prisoners and properly and give them rights and so forth. That's certainly one side of the argument. Of course, the other side is that, well, these are potentially dangerous terrorists and we want to make sure that we protect our security, and that actually is more important in this case. And those are certainly the issues the court is going to have to deal with.
That's exactly right. The other side of the coin also involves the question of the information used to apprehend these terrorists and potentially the methods used to interrogate these terrorists, some of which the United States wants to treat as state secrets, and they're concerned if they give more access to courts to these people that they'll end up having to run into court all the time and basically say, we're not going to turn any of that over because it's all classified. And so there are lots of different complicated aspects to this. But I think the point she raised about being an example to the world is actually an argument that may well resonate with Justice Kennedy. Of all the justices, he's probably the greatest internationalist and the one who seems to pay close attention to how the rest of the world looks at the United States. It's become rather controversial. But in the context of the military commissions, it may be one of the influences that could lead him to a more liberal result in these cases.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Ken in Monroe. Ken, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. The question I've got is, what are your guys' feeling in terms of how the Supreme Court's going to rule on the Second Amendment?
Like all the other cases, I think this one is going to come down to 5-4. I just don't know, to be honest with you. It's going to be very, very close.
And I'm not allowed to have an opinion on that, so... I can't help you, Ken. But we mentioned this earlier. But this is a case that has huge implications, because if the court decides that the Second Amendment really does mean that there's supposed to be a state-run militia and that's what the right to bear arms is all about, that could open the door to a whole flood of gun control legislation at the state level all over the place. Could it not?
Oh, no, absolutely it could. And the other aspect of that I think that's important is they're going to decide this question in an election year. It's no secret that gun rights has been an important election issue. I'm sure it's true in Wisconsin. I think it's true in Michigan and a number of other potential swing states in the 2008 presidential election. And while I think from last year one might have thought that the liberal base would get very excited about the Supreme Court's turn to the right, if the Supreme Court comes down in a liberal way on the gun control case, I can imagine a lot of that the conservative base, not that all people who believe in gun rights are conservative, but that the NRA and others would be out in force, really energized by an adverse Supreme Court ruling.
Thanks, Ken, for the call. Appreciate you joining us this morning. Did you have a follow-up or anything else you wanted to ask about?
No, that was it. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Ken. Let's go next to Steele in Neenah. Steele, good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Maybe you can help me with my history. Am I right that President Kennedy was one of the few Catholic presidents we've had?
Probably correct.
And then what I was interested in, the justices went to church this Sunday to get, you know, for the beginning of the season, and if I heard right, it was maybe five or six of the justices were Catholics, and it seems like over time when I've heard about maybe a Catholic president, there's all sorts of talk, yet I, you know, it's just sort of a surprise to me that that many justices were Catholics. I don't know what, you know, if it means a hill of beans, but I thought it was interesting.
What do we know about the religious background of the current members of the Supreme Court?
I believe the caller is right that there are five Catholics on the court. I may be wrong, it may be six, but it is something that people have remarked on. Most of them are the more recent appointees. But historically, the Catholic justices have been all over the map ideologically. The example most people point to is Bill Brennan, who was Catholic and one of the most liberal justices in history. At the moment, the Catholic justices on the court tend to be on the conservative side, and I think that may have something to do with the abortion rights controversy. But it is, you know, it is one of those things when you look at the demographics of the court that does stand out.
Well, none of the current justices was appointed by a Catholic president, I believe.
That's correct. Kennedy's appointment to the court was a White. He retired some years ago and passed away.
Let's go to the phones again, and this time it's BJ and Fond du Lac. BJ, good morning. You're on the air. Please tell
morning,
us your comment or question.
Yes, I had a couple quick comments and then a question. Comments were with the Guantanamo detainees and such. The U.S. taxpayer dollars pay for the leases of the military bases around the world, do they not? And if so, wouldn't that mean that in a sense that is U.S. soil? Then also with the cruel and unusual punishment for capital punishment, depending on the crime and how that person committed their murders or their crimes, lethal injection to me is not anywhere near cruel. And then question would be, if the public did not care for some of the justices, is there any way that the public can oust any of the justices that are there? So, and I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call, BJ. Other than impeachment, I don't believe there's any way for anyone to remove a sitting justice. Those are lifetime appointments, are they not?
That is correct.
I'm trying to remember if a justice of the Supreme Court has ever been impeached. I know that there were a lot of bumper stickers, impeach Earl Warren, but that never happened either.
Correct, and at one time there was a bit of a push to try and impeach William O. Douglas. I believe in the 19th century, Salmon P. Chase was impeached but acquitted. It is a rare thing to have happen, and I think it's highly unlikely that we'll be seeing one anytime soon.
Well, one of the things that if you look at the history of the Supreme Court of the United States, presidents have had kind of tough luck for the most part, I would say up until some of the more recent appointees. But for the most part, presidents who make appointments thinking that a judge will rule in a certain way ideologically oftentimes get surprised, and the justice turns out to be exactly the opposite in terms of their ruling. And Earl Warren would be a prime example of that.
Yes, Earl Warren certainly would be. Harry Blackmun. There are others. But, you know, sometimes it's because the issues that are important change over time, and so a justice who might agree with the president on the things that matter at one moment, when the agenda changes at the court, they find themselves on opposite sides of something else. And sometimes justices are picked for reasons that have nothing to do with their ideology, and I think Earl Warren falls in that category. That was, as I understand, sort of a deal that was made back in the day with Earl Warren running for vice president at one time, and that there was an understanding, a political understanding, that he was going to get appointed to the court, and so the fact that he turned out to be something different than what Eisenhower would have wanted partly resulted from the fact he wasn't picked because of his ideology to begin with.
The topic under consideration this hour, we're talking about the Supreme Court and its upcoming term. It's under its new Chief Justice Roberts. We saw his style and his rulings in the last session. Now we've got another session coming up. Certainly the court has leaned farther to the right in the last term. There's some question about what direction it will turn in this upcoming term, and particularly given the cases that are being discussed. If you have a question or a comment, something you'd like to discuss related to the Supreme Court and the cases that it's going to be taking this year, you can join our discussion. Here's how to do it. First of all, you can call a toll-free. Toll-free number, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. And if you're in Madison, use our local number at 263-1890. And if you're a really modern person, you can send us an email. And the address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. My guest this hour is Edward Lazarus. He's a lawyer and a legal analyst and is the author of the book Closed Chambers, The Rise, Fall, and Future of the Modern Supreme Court. Well, the Supreme Court, obviously the appointment of justices to the Supreme Court is something that's done by the president, and then the Senate has to confirm those justices. And the idea of that, a little checks and balances, is supposed to provide a way to prevent the court from being too political, but has that worked out historically? How political has the court been historically, and do you think it's more political now than it has been in the past?
I think that there are political ups and downs on with respect to that issue. In the 1930s, the court was very, very politicized. What were known as the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse were striking down aspects of Roosevelt's New Deal. President Roosevelt even suggested a plan to pack the court with supporters of his own by basically expanding the number of justices that would be sitting up there. In the end, one of the sitting justices actually changed his vote on some key cases, and it's called the switch in time that saved the nine. And so that was a very politicized period in the court's history. Before the Civil War, the Dred Scott case, highly political court. There was a lot of, in fact, discussion between some of the justices and President Buchanan about how that case was going to come out. But I do think we're living through one of those eras. Bush v. Gore is not really too far in our rear view window, and that was a case when, for the first time in U.S. history, a Supreme Court actually determined the outcome of an election. And I think that leaves a kind of politicized taste in a lot of people's mouths.
Let's take a call from Janice in La Crosse. Good morning, Janice. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, and good morning to both of you. Yes, I'm Catholic, so I guess I'm very pro-life, and I listened to Justice Thomas last night on 60 Minutes, or whatever program, CBS, I think. Anyway, they were interviewing him, and he, I guess, one of the discussion was that they had said about him is that he did not think abortion should be a federally decided decision, whatever you want to call it, that it should go to the states. And then they commented that if it did go to the states, which of course I would be for, that it would be like 40% at least to get, you know, to knock down abortion, to not make it, quote, legal. And I thought, oh, how wonderful. Anyway, that was the comment that I was really excited about.
Okay.
Right, well, Justice Thomas was on 60 Minutes last night, and he has been gone on record many times as saying that Roe versus Wade should be reversed. And if it were, it would leave it up to each individual state whether or not to criminalize abortion.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Did you have something else?
No,
okay. Let's go next to Troy in Chorp. Can that be right?
Thorpe,
that's what I thought. Not everyone's typing is as good as mine.
Just wondering what the guest thinks about the Indiana Voter ID Act and if the court will kick it back as a poll tax, possibly, or if they kick it back and say, well, you can do this without a charge on the voter IDs, or, you know, how he thinks that's going to fall. Kind of interesting.
I think there are a whole series of cases, and not just the poll tax, but other ones, which talk about access to the ballot. And I think it, you know, 60% to 40%, I'd say that Justice Kennedy will say that it requiring a voter ID in the absence of strong evidence of fraud at the ballot box is a restriction on ballot access that he's not going to countenance.
Well, interestingly enough, on the Indiana law, you can do an absentee ballot in Indiana without any identification at all.
That is also true, although how you get that ballot, I actually don't know the technicalities of how that works.
Troy, anything else you want to add there quickly?
No, that's all.
Okay, thanks a lot, Troy. We'll try and, let's see. No, I don't think I'm going to be able to get another call in. I would take one more, but then I know I'd get burned, and suddenly it would be 8:59, and I wouldn't be off the air yet, and that would be awful. The court's session, how long is the session? And just kind of sum up for us in the last minute that we have kind of how you think things are going to play out here. But how long is this? How long does the session last, and when will they actually start making coming out publicly with decisions?
The session lasts until basically the end of June, and they decide all the cases. They'll hear oral argument up through April, and then they will have decided all of the cases from this term by the end of June. The big decisions don't usually start rolling out until the spring, but if something's heard in October, sometimes they'll get a decision out as early as January and February. But this is going to be a term, like last year, closely watched. A lot of big cases, we didn't talk about some of them, child pornography, sentencing disparities between crack and powder cocaine. There are just a host of cases already on the docket this year that are going to be very closely watched. I think it'll be a more liberal term than last term in ways that will surprise the common wisdom. And I think the court will play a role in the election for that reason.
Thank you very much for your analysis. And it's been an interesting hour. I'd like to do another hour on this, but that's just me.
Anytime.
All right. Thank you so much. Edward Lazarus is a lawyer and legal analyst. He's also the author of the book Closed Chambers, The Rise, Fall, and Future of the Modern Supreme Court. Peter Donalds produced this hour of radio, and Karen Prager handled the phone calls. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.